also works especially well because the sugyas are related, so we're going to segue from one into the other. We talked yesterday about the question of whether women can shecht or not, and we noted that really the vast majority of Rishonim hold yes, and that it's pashut yes, and there isn't much to talk about. That essentially, nashim are absolutely kashul shechita. The issue is, there are really two issues that were raised, which we assumed, and will continue to assume, are really separate issues. One is Tosfos quoting the Hilchos Eretz Yisrael, Eldad Hadani, who said that nashim should not shecht. And the issue was Daitan Kalas. We talked about the fact that Daitan Kalas is a mysterious phrase, doesn't have one consistent interpretation. In this context, and probably other contexts also, it does not seem to refer to intelligence or education. Maybe refers to a concern of fainting. That was one possibility that some had. And then we discussed that one should not be too shocked at the stereotypical assessments here, because first of all, there are theories within a view that's not accepted la halacha, and then we added the Shevet Sofer. This is not even that these are views of all women, but they're views that just counteract our topic for today, the Rov Mitzuyin Eitzel Shchutim Foundation. Should also add that I saw my dear friend Rabbi Shmuel Maybrook, Shlita and Hasefer on Chulin. Sefer Yismach Lev has a discussion about the Hilchos Eretz Yisrael, a piece about that, and he discusses there that perhaps this can narrow it down even further. He quotes from the Kaftar of Aferach, who discussing, even just to explain the theoretical position of the Hilchos Eretz Yisrael, that his perception of women as more likely to faint is only true where he came from, or maybe it was only true where he came from. But by us, writes the Kaftar of Aferach, there's no distinction, and there's no reason to even consider that an issue at all. And then we discussed, just parenthetically, that the Hilchos Eretz Yisrael has other shitas also. The Rishonim quote that in general he was innovating chumras that are not accepted la halacha. And another example they mentioned was the idea that if one doesn't make a bracha on shchita, the shchita is no good. So that's certainly not how we assume on a number of levels. But we offered one possible link between the two. We're not sure exactly how to connect the dots, but maybe the Hilchos Eretz Yisrael had an even more intense view of what the purpose of shchita is in terms of how we're supposed to connect to the mentality of shchita. And once he has a more intense view about that, he may also have a narrower standard as to who gets to shecht. But again, we did not really have a way to connect those two. But Rabbi Maybrook in his sefer over there, so he notes that maybe the Hilchos Eretz Yisrael was saying that it's similar to the issue that we have, this point about the having to make a bracha, that since we see there are concerns about mumer and about kusi, so maybe we want to offset that, and that we want to make sure that the individual is not looking lahachis and has a sense that it's a mitzvah. So therefore, we insist on a bracha, and without the bracha, it's not going to be good. He compares it to what the Mishnah says, that if you have a shliach tzibor who has indicated that he has certain challenges in emunah, he says, amodim, modim, shma, shma, he seems to indicate a belief in two rishuyos, so we remove him from davening. So to hear, maybe there's a similar kind of consideration for shchita. But we also noted, and this we will segue into today's topic, that Rav Soloveitchik in his Shiurim addressed the other consideration, that the Augur is quoted by the Beis Yosef as saying that the minig is that women do not shecht, and minig mevatel halacha. That should be the bottom line. And the Beis Yosef himself did not adopt this, adopted there or in Shulchan Aruch, and he writes that, how do you know there is such a minig? Just because you never saw anyone do it doesn't mean that's meaningful, or you know, in a raya. And we don't have the kind of frequency that would have made this into any kind of a relevant datum. The fact that women haven't been seen shechting, maybe they weren't interested in shechting. We don't necessarily know that that's meaningful. So the Shach, who quoted, has the observation that perhaps by a minig, we do say lo re'inu raya, and we talked a little bit about why there should be a different standard for the Ikra Halacha and for a Minig, even though still, either way, if it doesn't come up with enough frequency, that's still going to impact the relevance of not seeing something. And we discussed how Rav Soloveitchik understood that the issue with having women shecht is because it was a public position. And that was indicated by the fact that it requires a Kabbalah, and we mentioned historically also the role of the Shochet as kind of the assistant rabbi of the community, maybe the second most knowledgeable person in the community. And to that, the Rav connected it to the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim, in Perek Aleph, Halacha Hey, where he has an expansive position regarding Som Tassim Malacha Melech, Melech Vela Malka, that the Melech of a Klal Yisrael had to be male. So the Rambam understood this is true about any kind of appointment, any kind of srara, any kind of public office. So that plays a major role in the contemporary discussion about women rabbis. We mentioned there's a lot of controversy about it and about whether the Rambam's position is itself fully agreed upon and whether it's fully clear that that should be applied to the contemporary rabbinate. And then we noted that we don't think it necessarily has to be for this to be the current position, that really we have to take everything together, that there is a hanhaga of psak, I think we should say, there's a hanhaga of psak about how to look at the smicha for nashim issue. The hanhaga already, so then we bring in the shachs lorinu raya point, but we also mentioned that still the frequency and the relevance of something coming up as an issue. So in that context, we know that there have been women who are scholarly throughout Jewish history, even if it hasn't been a mass movement. And so then the question is, all right, is this a meaningful practice to abstain from ordaining women? So in order for it to be meaningful, it has to connect to some kind of halachic value. So this idea of srara, which some like Rav Soloveitchik and others felt strongly, others felt less strongly, but whether or not it's an absolute halachic conclusion that is inescapable, it's still very relevant to assessing how a hanhaga came about. So therefore, it's sufficient for that purpose. And presumably, like Rav Shechter and Rav Bleich and others explain, it's connected to a tznius concept. And we mentioned also that that could explain why the hanhaga developed differently regarding Ger and Isha, which theoretically should have had similar dinner. Sorry, Gilad, yes.
So the Rambam learns it from points in the kin?
Yeah, there's a Sifrei that has something like that. That
is that like normal that we to learn at the general case of like the most extreme case?
Well, the question is whether that's meant to only be the most extreme case or whether that is just one example of the overall din. Because there is a lot to be said, and we're not in a position from a time perspective. Maybe you can find another opportunity to do it maybe on a Sunday or some other time in the future. The whole question of the Rambam's position on Sarara and to what extent is it accepted by other Rishonim, certainly a debatable point, and what would be in the context of Sarara, what would be part of this definition, is something about which a lot has been written. And again, I think it's one thing if we're going to look at it as the purely halachic definition of that sugya, what exactly would the maskana be. But I think in the case of smicha for women and rabbinic ordination, so the practice of Klal Yisrael is a broader factor which may or may not be based on this. So there are those who feel that it is, and there are those who feel like it's one part of the discussion. There are other aspects. And therefore, I think even if one were to decide that the Sarara is either not a halachic consideration at all or isn't relevant to the contemporary rabbinate, I think there's a lot to argue about as far as that's concerned, but even if one were to come to that conclusion, you would not dismiss the hanhaga of Klal Yisrael to this point, at the same time as saying that it's very possibly a factor in where that hanhaga developed from. And that's itself a theory that is subject to disagreement. Hi.
Is Sarara for Shechita an issue nowadays?
So, I mean, nowadays do we have people... Well, nowadays,
like,
even less so.
Is Shechi considered a like such a respected position as it was back in the day?
So, yes and no. So, clearly our communal structure is very different than the European shtetl, where the Shochet had this knowledgeable kind of role and was looked up to in that kind of way, and we don't even know who our shochtim are today. But we do work with a more organized kind of kashra system, where we do assume that the shochtim are qualified and are put through a process to assess that. So it does have that overlap, even though we don't...
In terms of women nowadays.
So that's how the Rama leaves it, that the minig is not to do it. And it's, if one assumes that that's the explanation, there is still this component of it being a Kabbalah, or in that mystic, but receiving a confirmation that you are able to do this. And here in the Shiurim, the Rav emphasized that that was a part of how he came to that conclusion. But the bottom line is, that's what the Rama writes. The Sfardim have a different bottom line. I don't know what the actual practice is. But the Shulchan Aruch doesn't have a problem with it at all. And the Rama writes that that's the minhag. That's how we leave things. Okay. So far, so good. Any further questions about that?
Just stop the recording and start you
know? Not necessarily. Doesn't matter. Yeah.
The Rambam, he discusses Sarar in the context of Gatorade.
Yes.
So, does he ever discuss that in the context of other things, or we just apply that to women?
He has both. He has halacha dollars about Gerim and halacha hay is about. So there is some question about, you know, why don't we apply the same logic to both? So why don't we say there shouldn't be smicha for Gerim either? So Gerim happens to be a more complicated question in terms of dayanus, in terms of practicing as the shul rabbinate. So if you look in the Shiurim, the Rav has one approach to that. There are other approaches that are suggested as well. We're suggesting a little differently that the attitude towards smicha for women being more absolute than the attitude towards gerim, I think, could be connected to the idea that it's not necessarily about the sugya as much as about how the anhaga developed. And the anhaga was probably, or very possibly, influenced by sneas considerations, which would lead to a different application. Again, that's all theory, but we know that one way or another, the mesorah of practice carries a tremendous weight. So that seems to be present, this mesorah, and the question of how you explain it, I think, it's more in the realm of theory. Okay.
One more?
Yeah, sure.
Where does Rambam get this concept of Sarara?
So that, again, is a big question. I guess it seems to be based on this sifrei about Som Tassim Alech HaMelech. Again, the topic, we want to talk about that topic head on, so then that requires a little more time, or a lot more time, and I'm happy to do that. There's a lot of literature about it. Most often quoted, there's a lot, but just to give you one example, what's most often quoted is the Tshuva of Moshe Feinstein, where he talks about whether a Mashgiach, for kashrus purposes, has the position of Srara, the authority that he has in that role. And what about a situation where you wanted to have a woman mashgiach? So is that a position of srara, and is that affected by this consideration? So that tshuva is very often quoted as part of this debate. It certainly touches upon some of the key themes. Rav Moshe goes through there whether this was the view of other rishonim, but you see clearly he is worried about at least the chadchila. In that case, it was an extreme scenario where this was an almana who didn't have any other parnasa other than this, and there's a lot of back and forth in that tshuva. There's much else that's written about this also. The Mishpatei Uziel, Rav Uziel has some important tshuvas about this topic. It was a major question in the history of Israeli politics, as you can imagine. There's a lot of literature about this regarding not just the rabbinate, but shul presidents, and the question also of shul boards, even not presidents. There's a lot written about this, and if you want, we can give this more attention on a Sunday or another theme outside of the chulin slot. We'll mention also one other Mar Makum, if you want a very pilpulish approach to this Tosfos about why should women possibly not shecht according to the Hilchos Eretz Yisrael. So I'll give you one Mar Makum. I remember I mentioned this to Rabbi Bleich Shlita, who we'll be making more reference to soon, when I took my bechina for the Kol Elyon. It was one of the questions he asked me about this tosus, about what should it be an issue. And there is a very pilpulish approach, which also for time reasons I won't go into now, but you can take a look if you want to look at a more not derech hapshat approach in the Tshuvas Chaim Britzono. Tshuvas Chaim Britzono was a Talmud of the Noda Bihuda, and he has a very populish approach to this. And I should remember that in my Kol Elyon Bechina, I remember mentioning this to Rabbi Bleich, and I think he was happy with it. Okay, so in any event, so on that topic, so now this segues us in to this issue of Rov Mitzuyan Eitzel Shchuta Mumchenheim, and how to understand that. And I mentioned Rabbi Bleich, so for the sake of this discussion, you'll see between today and tomorrow, so we have a triple grid discussion. We'll be talking about three grids who have a lot to say about this topic, because the shiurim of the Rav Soloveitchik that we've been referencing has a lot to say about this. But one of the major authors on this topic was the original grid Soloveitchik. The original Rabbi Yeshua Ber Soloveitchik, the Rav's great-grandfather, the author of the Tshuvas Beis Halevi, in the beginning of Chelek Beis of his Tshuvas, has about 8 or 9 Tshuvas about this issue. So we'll be discussing him as well. And the Grid Bleich, Rabbi Bleich has an essay about this also, which probably more tomorrow will make reference, or maybe a little bit today also, will make reference to also. So there are three grids that are going to be very relevant to considering some of the implications of Rov Mitzuyan Eitzel Shchita Mumchenheim. I think I mentioned the other day that one of the rabbeim was saying to me that part of what's so exciting about being able to learn the first parak of Chulin is so much shas material in this parak and so much that's the sodistic. So he was saying that normally when he teaches other mesechtas, pretty early on he has to make reference to the first parak of Chulin because that's where you find the principles of Rov. So we're going to be able to see it b'mkomo. That's a special schuz. But the truth is, we're not fully there yet. That the sugya of Rov, the big sugya of Rov min haTorah, is later on in the first parak. Rov and Chazaka and Bez Hashem, we should have a lot to say about that. Some very major packed shas material, Dafir Aleph and around there. So, major exciting anticipation for the future. We have to borrow from it a little bit now. So just like with other mesechtas, he was saying that they have to turn to the first parak of Chulin. So here, we're in the first parak of Chulin, but we're not at the main discussion of Rov. We're borrowing from it a little bit now here on Gimel Amud Beis, but trying to keep things in some degree of order and some degree of context. So we're borrowing a little bit early from the sugya of Rov. But there's a lot to try to figure out to understand how this works. And what does it mean? And in order to do so, we're going to have to really explore what a Rov is and what it could be and what does this Rov mean. So first, just to lay out some of the pieces. So practically speaking, what does it mean? And the Gemara has this principle here that we can assume that those who would be involved in Shechita know what they're doing. So how far does that assumption go? And it seems that there are at least three shitas about this. Three different understandings of how absolute is this. Does this really mean rest easy, you don't have to worry about anything? So what does it mean? So what are the possibilities? Right? There are at least three of them. What could it mean practically speaking? You don't have to worry about anything. So, if you saw, for example, with the Rush, right, so the Rush understands that it means l'chadchila anyone can shecht because you will check afterwards. So you don't have to check them before they shecht. You'll ask them afterwards. Hi.
Maybe we misread the Rush, but he wasn't arguing on the concept that we paskin the roof shofamer mumchen.
No, we seem to assume, even though in the Gemara there might be some discussion, we seem to assume the Rosh Chutin are Mumchim. Question, Rov Mitzvinis or Shchit are Mumchim. The question is, practically speaking, what does that mean for us? What can we do with that Rov? So here you have a debate among the Rishonim. So some say it means that you can give them to Shacht because the assumption is you will check afterwards. Other Rishonim understand from the other direction that you don't have to check afterwards. But that may mean that you won't have them Shach L'Cherchila. So if somebody of an undetermined knowledge level shachts, so you can assume that it was kosher and you don't necessarily have to check afterwards. Right? And that's what Rashi says in our daf. It's the easiest to look at. Mumchen hein. Hilkach laboy lemibdike. Therefore, you don't have to check. You can assume that what they did was good.
Rashi is alone in that camp?
Not necessarily. But that's another view. But presumably, you don't have mashach l'chachila, but after the fact, you can rely that it was effective. And then there's another view, the Torah quotes, and also seems to be the view of the Ra'ah in the Bet HaKabayis. So you got a chance to look at that through the link. All right, you'll get a chance to look at it tomorrow, hopefully. That seems to understand that this is really across the board a solid premise. That you can give them to Shach L'Chachila and you don't have to check afterwards. So, what is this machlokes about? Let's start off thinking this way. What would you decide on your own to do about this principle? What would you decide as a matter of halachic policy? If we told you, we gave you this information, and we said that Rove Shochtim know what they're doing, and that that has some halachic value, that much you know, and you know that, God willing, we'll learn Daf Yud Aleph in this parak, and we'll see that Al Pi Din Torah, we rely on a rove. So you have this ammunition, you have a rove. So what would you say as a matter of policy? Would you give a untested individual to Shach L'Chachila? Would you make some effort to find out afterwards? Or would you just say that, okay, I got a rove here, so I'm not asking any questions. Maury?
I feel like it really, everything sort of comes down to what how we define mumchen. If a mumchen is able to shach completely, then, and we're assuming that rove, shochtim, are mumchenim, then they could all shach completely. Then it sounds like maybe the Torah and the Bnei Kabbayis make the most sense, meaning that I feel like it would be harder to try to stretch our definition of rove to be different in this context. The rove might be the same thing it means across the board, but I think that the burden in the halakha context would be on trying to understand what mumchen means.
All right, that's interesting. I'm going to ask you to explain that a little bit more, but just as far as your assumption, just know you say rove means the same thing across the board, so we'll see that rove is subject to a lot of different applications. And a lot of that we'll get to see more when we see the sugya head on. But already it's certainly the case that rove means different things in at least two or three different ways. So there is strong basis to question what rove means here. It wouldn't require any radical deviation from an existing policy because rove already has different kinds of applications. But if you're saying you think that the question really should circle around mumchim, so what would you do with that? And are you saying, tell me if this is what you're saying, are you saying that maybe mumchim means a certain bare bones kind of knowledge that we can handle if we don't know any better? But ideally, we'd much rather have somebody who is actually thoroughly expert. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Okay, well, so has, Okay. So, see, after the fact, you can check if somebody's mumchen. So, either way, whether you want to talk about how to interpret mumchen or want to talk about rov, what policy would you think makes the most sense here? If you were going to pick a view among the Rishonim, you're going to pick a policy. Well, what are you going to do with this rov? Would you rely on it absolutely?
Sure, it depends where you are.
Okay. Explain.
You're in a place with a lot of Jews, and maybe you can rely on this, but if you're in the middle of nowhere.
Well, so that's interesting by itself. Because even with or without Jews, we're kind of assuming that you can tell from an animal how it was killed. Right, so you can tell if it was shot, if it had its neck broken. So you see that it was shechted. So then we know somebody tried to perform Jewish ritual slaughter on that. So the question is that enough? Can we work off the assumption that somebody who tried to kill this animal in a Jewish slaughtering method, that therefore that's enough to tell us that it was somebody who was qualified? So you're raising an interesting question. Should we say that it depends on the environment? In some places, yes. In some places, no. Now, that goes to one core question here. What exactly do we mean by rov? Right?
I was going to point out that what Rami is saying, there might be a basis for that in the Rambam.
Mm-hmm.
Where he says that if you lose an animal...
Mm-hmm.
And if you lose an animal and then you find it
shechted,
then you can, so it's okay. But mashin came if you find it in the shuk or if you find it in the trash.
So you're saying, therefore, the environment is going to be.
Right, there might be the contextual thing. So Rami is saying that, the shita would make the most sense, but it depends on context, so there might be a basis for that. I mean, the Torah, Vedic Abayas, maybe they're not saying that. In a place where, you know, it wouldn't be shy to say it. But then again, maybe like in, the best place possible.
But do you think it's a matter of policy? You're saying the policy should shift depending on the environment. But let's say to give somebody the shachach achila. I don't know whether he knows hilchos shchita, but I could take out a few minutes and give him a fahar. Would you say, no, there's no point, because I got this rove, so...
Well, don't we see, at least in a few Rishonim, that they explain the process of being a mumchen and shkita as practicing?
Okay.
And being taught, and at least...
But you didn't see all that happen. You just happen to see this guy, you don't know what his story is. And he says, oh, you're hungry, I'm going to chef. Do you want something? So, should you investigate?
I mean,
you're not in any rush.
The rush of shita over here... You can almost ask, like, what's the point? If it's like a field that anyone can check, we just have to check it afterwards, then that's a statement more on shkita, it seems like. That shkita is not such an important thing that I could take off, but like, anyone can do it, we'll just check.
Well, maybe it's important, but we have to find out on one end or the other.
That also implies you know who shafted it, the rush.
Right. Well, perhaps, or you don't necessarily know, because you know that it was shafted by someone. But let's say right now you're about to see someone shafted. So should you be mavar whether he knows what he's doing, or just say I got this robe?
The Rosh is almost reading like I'll call Mocha and like for shkita, like whatever, just check the food before you eat it.
But he's not saying it's absolute. But he's saying you do have to check it afterwards. And the fact that you can check afterwards is enough reason to rely on him now.
You can check the meat, or
you can check him. You can ask him if he knows what he's doing. So that's one level of vigilance to check afterwards. Here, Rashi is saying you don't have to do that, but presumably l'chachila, you should check. And the other Rishonim are saying you don't have to check on either end. So what I'm trying to ask you is that, would you think that in general, in any other principle of halacha, that we rely on rov even when we could get more information? Like, what is rov? Is rov some kind of absolute hashkacha that does not require us to even think about it at all? Or should we say that rov is a tool when we don't know what the story is? If we don't have the ability to ascertain the truth, so then we have the right to follow rov. But if we could find out the truth, maybe it's not right to follow Rove. Right?
Can we plug this into Hanhagar Bira?
Absolutely. We haven't explained yet the terms Hanhagar Bira. We've discussed it this year?
No.
So we will talk about, God willing, when we get to the Sugya of Rove and Chazaka, and all of that fascinating material that will surround that. So these tools to decide what our policy is going to be. So Mori is referencing the fact that the Achronim have different ways of categorizing them. That sometimes you really don't know what the story is, but you're entitled to follow a certain path, which we call a hanhaga, so policy of behavior. And sometimes we would assume a little more than that, that what we're using is a tool to really try to ascertain what is true and what is not true. And that's an important discussion, but here, even before that, you might recall last year we discussed in Halacha Mamon Acharov, so we came up in that discussion. But here, even before that, you might say, okay, but why do I need either of those? Why don't I just ask what's going on? Is this Rove so solid, according to, let's say, the Ra'ah, that there's just no value in, no initiative to clarify things any further? So there's a lot more we're going to have to figure out about this, but we're going to run out of time. So I'm going to put the following in front of you and ask you that tomorrow during Seder, let's assume right now that we'll start at 1 for sure, and a little bit earlier, but so we'll still have a regular full Seder before. So I want you to think about the following possibility. And as you look at additional makoros, keep this question in mind. As we said, there are different kinds of rov. There is a concept called the ruba d'issa kaman and the ruba d'lessa kaman. What do those phrases mean? There's a lot of possibilities. I'm going to give one straightforward way of distinguishing between them. It's not the only way, but let's work off this definition for now. A rov d'issa kaman is essentially a statistical rov. That when you look out at the world population and you're able to see that 65% of people do this and 35% of people don't do this, so then that's a rove. You can assume that whatever is unknown and is in front of you is a part of the greater part of the population. Let's call that for now a ruba d'issa kaman. A ruba d'lessa kaman, let's define it as follows. We're not dealing with any kind of numbers that we have in front of us to analyze. But this is really closer to what we call a chazaka. That there's a certain default presumption about how people behave. And that when you don't have any further information, it's reasonable to assume that the default is in effect. So we don't actually know numbers. Is it 60% of people, or is it 80% of people, or is it whatever? But this is down by default the way people act. Let's work with those two definitions for a moment, okay? So to say that there's one kind of rove that is about saying most people do X, Y, and Z, because we have numbers and we see that that's the reality. Or, alternatively, it's not about numbers, it's just about the default human nature. So here, now I'm going to ask you three possibilities. Rov mitzuyin eitzel shchita mumchenheim. Does that mean that, simply speaking, the largest number of people within the population who would be doing this would be people who know what they're doing? Call that, for our purposes, a ruba d'issa kaman. Or, possibility number two, should we say that, no, we have no idea how many people are one way or the other way. But, stop, a person is going to shech. Why would somebody shech and go to all that effort? And it's possibly going to end up treif because he doesn't know what he's doing. he didn't care about kashrus, he could just shoot the animal. So the stam person who would do this probably knows what he's doing. Or is it a third possibility? It's neither of the above two, which is also, as we'll see, possible. So I want you to think about those questions during tomorrow's Seder, and that will be the framework for us to further apply this issue. Just to give one example, so what Rami brought up about circumstances, so maybe it depends what kind of rove we're talking about. That if we're saying it's the first rove, that, well, we can assume that 90% of all the people who are doing any shlita around here know what they're doing. So then maybe that's true in one place, but maybe it's not true in another place. And maybe it's going to be sensitive to what the circumstances are. But maybe if we were to say that, no, it's linked to the numbers. We have no idea what the numbers are. But the default is that a person who would be shechting makes sense. He probably knows what he's doing. And therefore, that might be true anywhere in the world. Even if there is a decent amount of people who would be doing it the other way. Or is it a completely different third model, which is highly possible. As we'll see, that it's neither of those two, and it is a completely different application. Okay, you got your task, Gilad?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. We generally say that, like, when it comes to a rogue and a rogue, that rogue is short, that always wins.
That what?
That rogue and karma, that rogue is... So I was going to ask, is that true for rogue to be karma and zero? Or is...
Yeah, that involves a lot of moving parts. So I think that we're going to hold off for now. But so just to quickly recap, so the part about the notion that we already recapped, but just to quickly recap these last few minutes. So we talked about the fact that the Gemara mentions this idea that Rov Mitzuyin Eitzel Shchuta Mumchenheim, and the big machlokus Rishonim, how far you go with that. Does that mean that we can rely on this Rov to let anybody shecht to begin with, because we'll check afterwards? Or does it mean that, no, you don't have to check afterwards, but then presumably you shouldn't do this l'chadchila, but it tells us that if an animal was shechted, at least b'di'eved, you can assume that that's good and there's no need to actually check up afterwards? Or should we say the most expansive application, that you can give anyone the shechachila and you don't have to check afterwards? And what I was trying to elicit from you is that it's a little bit of a surprising policy. Because one would think that Rov, however much significance you give Rov, but in a circumstance where you can figure out things more directly, you have in front of you the ability to see what actually happened, one would think that there wouldn't be a need to recourse to Rov, whether you call it a Birur or a Chazaka or a Birur or an Haga or anything else. You would think that Rov is really only there when you don't have otherwise full information. And it's a very solid principle. It's a principle of Minat Torah. So we wouldn't say that you have to give up on this if you're not able to figure it out. But if you are, then presumably one would probably think that it's a good idea to do that. So the idea that there's a view in Rishon, we don't even have to do that much, is surprising to us. So I left you with the question of, is this relevant to understanding what we mean by Rove? Is Rove here a statistical Rove? Most people are doing this? Is it a human psychology default kind of principle that stam a person doing this would be doing it under these circumstances? Or is it a third possibility? God willing, we'll see tomorrow what to do with this. All right, I wish everyone a wonderful day. It should be only good things. And I will see you, God willing, tomorrow morning.